Again, this is Bucer versus Bucer, and counsel for the appellant may approach. Mr. McIntosh, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Judge, judges of the Nebraska Court of Appeals, I'm Ryan McIntosh of Brant Horn Halstrom and Stilmach on behalf of the appellant, Justina Garrett, formerly known as Justina Bucer. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal deals with a custody modification wherein the only issue before the court was custody of one of the party's 5 minor children, Jackson. This action started with a complaint for modification and motion for ex parte custody, which was granted by the district court. This resulted in the minor child moving from his primary residence in Hemmingford, Nebraska to Lincoln, Nebraska with Mr. Bucer. Following trial, the district court found a material change in circumstances had occurred and awarded physical custody of Jackson to Mr. Bucer. The district court also restricted the party's telephonic contact and added a provision essentially allowing the minor children to limit their own parenting time with the non-custodial parent upon reaching the age of 15. This court is limited in the fact that the order for modification is devoid of any substantive findings of fact. The only findings were that it is in Jackson's best interest to remain in Lincoln and that he seems to have a good routine and is doing well in Lincoln. There were extremely serious allegations that were made in an ex parte affidavit that were all addressed at trial and disputed by Ms. Garrett with her own evidence. However, we are left to speculate as to whether the district court found any of the allegations to be true or credible. Instead, it appears that the district court treated the temporary order as a status quo and determined that it was in Jackson's best interest to remain in Lincoln. Essentially, what we have here is that the change in circumstances was that Jackson is now living in Lincoln rather than anything that occurred prior to the complaint for modification. That's all that we're able to glean from the findings of fact.
So it's your view of the order that the finding of the material change of circumstance was the best interest. Is that what you're saying the court's finding is?
I think the court's finding, I think the case law is that a court must find a material change in circumstance has occurred, and that can be based on the interest of the minor child changing and new best interest. What I think we have here is that the court essentially found that it would not be in his best interest to return to the status quo because he's now in Lincoln. And so I think that the court misapplied the material change in circumstances case law.
But was that because he seemed to be doing better in Lincoln?
Well, the findings that we have is that he's doing well in Lincoln. What we don't have is anything to dispute that Jackson was doing very well in Hemmingford, that he was flourishing in Hemmingford. All we have is that he's doing well in Lincoln. We don't have anything that he's doing better in Lincoln, just that his best interest would not be served in going back. We believe that the district court abused its discretion in this matter. Specifically, as I just said, there are no findings to contradict Ms. Garrett's evidence that Jackson was doing well in Hemmingford, that he was a model student, that the numerous medical and mental health services that Ms. Garrett was taking Jackson to. I don't think any evidence to contradict that he was doing well in school and doing well in Ms. Garrett's home, other than these allegations that we have in the ex parte order that were disputed by Ms. Garrett and we have no findings about. The fact that Mr. Bucer did not seek any modification for the other two children in Ms. Garrett's home shows that there are no real issues with Ms. Garrett's fitness as a parent overall. Additionally, to get on to the other alleged errors, the parties attended mediation and came to an agreement regarding several fairly minor provisions of the parenting plan. First, the parties affirmed the existing custody order and that it allowed the parties unrestricted access for telephonic visitation and parenting time with the children. The only restrictions that the parties discussed in this stipulation, I think this was Exhibit 26 at trial, were that they want to call after 9 p.m. or during meal times. But other than that, unrestricted access to the children whenever they deem fit. Second, the parties agreed to be flexible in their summer parenting time, but they affirmed their underlying belief that the parents are entitled and should be able to exercise the parenting time that's been ordered for the children. The stipulation was often received by the district court at trial, and no other evidence or request was made by either party to alter any other provision. All we were dealing with at trial was the physical custody of Jackson. Nevertheless,
McIntosh, with respect to the telephonic visitation, does the court's order set a maximum, or does it set a floor for the telephonic visitation?
So the words that the court used were entitled to. So before we had specifically, no parent shall restrict the other parent's access, and we completely flipped that on its head, and then Appley in his brief characterizes this as, you know, this is doing the parties a favor. Now they have this guaranteed parenting time. Well, the unrestricted access had guaranteed parenting time before, and now we're restricting it to 2 days a week. And so this is a...
Is there anything in the court's order that adopts the stipulation of the parents?
Well, that's the point, Your Honor, is that the order specifically overrules and contradicts the stipulation that was received by the court. And that's the whole point of this is, if the court was going to do that, the parties need to be notified that under basic due process and really the best interest of the children. The court, without receiving any evidence, selected specific times to be called. And the appellee can characterize that as guaranteeing parenting time, but this is a case that's been modified 3 times in 4 years. This is the third modification since the decree of dissolution was entered. And it is completely impractical to say that this is establishing additional parenting time.
There was evidence of communication issues between the parties, so correct?
Extremely, extremely long ongoing issues.
Right. So was this his way of trying to prevent a fourth or fifth coming back, you know, time and time again, because these, especially when there's a communication issue between the parties, that this can be anticipated. So was he just trying to maybe tighten this down a little bit so that perhaps the parties could find a way to cooperate and get along by following his requirements?
It appears that way, Your Honor, but choosing this time, the twice a week, what time of day it was, I think the parties should have been notified of that so they could have put on evidence specifically as to whether weekend telephone calls would be better, whether it's right after school would be better. We don't have that. We had expert witnesses testify who are Jackson's providers, but we don't know. We don't know what telephonic time was best. The court could have asked that of the expert witnesses if it was going to make this change, and that did not occur. The other issue, besides restriction of telephone parenting time, and I think this is the clearest issue in this case, is the provision that allows the children to restrict their parenting time and with their non-custodial parent upon reaching the age of 15.
What led up to that? Why was that implemented?
The oldest child, Riley, was working, and I think there was some evidence, I believe this is in the record, Your Honor, had requested to forego her parenting time so that she could work. Ultimately, the parties, Ms. Garrett, exercised her parenting time, but we didn't even talk about this at trial beyond just saying that this was an issue. And this is, I think, a clear delegation, and it's only going to cause issues between the minor children and the non-custodial parent. I don't even know if it's going to cause issue between the parents. This is going to cause an issue between the non-custodial parent and the children, that the child is now 15 and thinks that they're in charge because a district court judge says they get to decide what undefined, and I think the language is pre-scheduled, non-negotiable activities. I don't know what that is. And I think that was a clear error for the court to make that the standard for a 15-year-old to decide that they don't have to go to their parents' house.
Does work qualify for that if she's got a job?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think that could have been spelled out. I don't know if it's a baseball game or a softball game or if it's work or if it's a sleepover with friends. We don't know.
So if the court would have said that they don't have to attend parenting time if they have work, that would have been fine. You just can't make it arbitrary.
I still don't think it's fine, Your Honor, because we didn't have any opportunity. We were not on notice that this was going to be an issue at trial, and we did not have any opportunity to present any evidence as to I mean, this applies to all five children, not just Jackson, which was the only issue at trial. So I still think it was an error.
Was the issue pled at all? Was that issue pled in any of the pleadings?
No, it was not pled.
Well, it did start out as he was trying to get custody of all the children, and then as the case proceeded and it got closer to time of trial, he abandoned his efforts as to the other children, and then it just became Jackson. Isn't that right?
That's correct. So it's a split custody situation. He had custody of two of the primary physical two children, and three children were in Ms. Garrett's care. The initial pleadings requested custody of all. But that was soon dropped, and if you look at the record before the court and the statements of counsel at the time of trial, and they only dealt with Jackson.
Right. Okay.
And I think that's conceded in Appley's brief that all we're talking about is custody of Jackson.
That was my understanding. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think we've managed to take you over your time again, so is there any other questions?
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And how much time did we go over?
34 seconds.
All right, we'll add that to Ms. Camplin's time. And Ms. Camplin, you may approach.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Lindsay Camplin. I am an attorney with McHenry Hazard Law in Lincoln, and I represent the appellee, Paul Boozer. This case started, as Mr. McIntosh alluded to, with very serious allegations, and they weren't minor by any means. This was a child who was on antipsychotic medications that were prescribed to him by a provider that only the mother knew about. The mother took this child to this provider. The evidence shows the father never knew the child was even seeing this doctor, never knew the child was on this antipsychotic medication, and that the mother never sent this medication to the father's home. Most of the father's visits throughout the year are weekends, Friday to Sunday. The evidence was that the Seroquel, if it was not given over those weekend visits, may not have as much of an impact from withdrawal like it would in the summer when the child went for 30 days at a time. So the child arrives for the July 2020 visit, is vomiting, is nauseous, is exhibiting extreme behaviors and reactions. The father contacts the mother wanting to know what's wrong, and she says, well, he just doesn't want to be there. She never tells him, oh, he's on it Seroquel and I didn't send it. She never tells him, oh, well, it might be a side effect from a medication he's taking. She blames him for it. The problem that we have is that we get to trial a year later, and she is still arguing that she did nothing wrong. She is still arguing that she had doctor's permission to wean him off the medication in advance of the visit, when the evidence shows that she is lying. She refilled that medication entirely in June of 2020. There is no evidence from the refills that she was weaning this child off the medication. The doctor's notes are all in evidence. There is no discussion with the doctors or the nurses about weaning this child off the medication.
Was there ever an explanation as to why she was not communicating this to your client?
She again blamed him. She claimed that she had told him once and had sent it before and he had never given it to the child. There is zero evidence that she ever did any of that. There are communications between the parties in evidence. In those communications, there is never any mention of the Seroquel. There is never any mention of this doctor out west that had prescribed the Seroquel. And so it is clear from the testimony and the evidence that when Mr. Boozer learned about this medication and contacted these providers and got this information, not only was he not given this information to begin with, but the other medication, the Vyvanse, was being sent in the wrong dosage. It was being sent in a bottle with a handmade label that had the wrong milligrams on it.
And I understand everything you're saying, but counsel's point is the court didn't seem to make any factual findings in that regard as it relates to the material change in circumstances, instead relying more on the temporary order was granted, we've got this change going on now, and now it's in the best interest to stay the way that we, you know,
and I would argue,
preserve the status quo as opposed to addressing what is the material change, right?
And I would argue differently. I would argue the material change was the escalation in parental behavior that the court found concerning at the time it entered the ex parte order. At the time of trial, nothing had changed. The mother doubles down on her argument that she did this in the best interest of the child, and the court found previously she was not acting in the best interest of the child when it granted the ex parte to the father, and it left custody with him after further hearing. And so the court did not have to necessarily say that now I agree there's a material change. They found one initially back on a temporary basis when they made that modification. with the mother not coming in and showing anything had changed, anything was different, the court clearly found that the child was doing better in the home, in addition to the fact that it had those concerns a year ago that had not been resolved. Had she come in and owned up to what happened or had an explanation for it or tried to show what would be different this time, perhaps then we would have an issue that no material change had been found.
Can you cite any case that's like that, where the material change took place as a part of the temporary and now we're at the trial and the court doesn't need to find a material change as it relates to the original basis of the temporary order?
I don't know that the court didn't find material change. I think they just said the material change has not, it occurred back then and it still exists now because she has not gone back and done anything to correct it. And the Lindblad case cited in my brief talks about the fact that escalation in parental behavior can be enough to be a material change. The fact that she took her angst and her anger towards dad to this level, that she was harming the child by not sending the medication, by not telling dad about the medication, that was concerning then. Nothing has changed as of the time of trial in that regard, and so that is still a concern, and that is the material change. Is that behavior escalated to that point in July 2020, and she just doubled down and kept acting that way for the next year.
Can you address the telephone in the summer?
Yes. So
restrictions.
So the Cook case that I had cited in my brief as well says that the district court can approve the parenting plan that the parties have submitted as modified if there were key elements that were missing. And I think the evidence at trial was very clear. There was a lot of blaming by Ms. Boozer against Mr. Boozer that he was restricting her access and that she didn't feel like she had enough contact with the children because it was not defined and because it was up to the children a lot of the times given their ages and the fact that they all have their own phones. She felt that he somehow was still restricting her contact. And so by giving her a minimum, a floor of 2 times a week, it guaranteed she would at least have that much time to talk to the kids. The children are not restricted from contacting her. They have their own phones. The evidence was that when they want to talk to her, they do. And I think it's clear with these parties, they need boundaries. They are continuing to argue about absolutely everything. They are continuing to accuse each other of abuse and other concerning behaviors. And so having these boundaries where it says, if the child wants to make that contact, they can do so anytime. But the parent needs to do it on this schedule so they are not overstepping, they are not interfering. I think that's appropriate. And I think the court was correct to find that that was necessary in this particular case.
And again, do you think that was his attempt to prevent an additional down the road problem?
I do. If you look back at the record, the previous modifications all involved communication issues as well. So I think that the court knew that this was a problem for these parties continually and that if there can, you know, at mediation, a lot of times parties will agree to things that they think gets them out the door, but isn't necessarily forward-thinking enough to think about all the future issues they might have. And the court saw that if we don't have a minimum, that mom gets to talk at least twice a week, and then she doesn't talk to them at all that week, she's going to blame dad for that. And we need to get the kids out of the middle of that.
So was the trial, though, just about Jackson? And so if the trial was about Jackson, how did we end up with all these orders as it relates to the others, and how does that, you know, relate to his due process argument here? Right?
In a sense, it was just about Jackson, but the parties came in with an exhibit they stipulated to that was a mediated agreement that modified the parenting plan for all five. So they came in with an agreement that said, this is the plan for all five children. Judge, we need you to tell us who has custody of Jackson, and that fits into this plan. And so the court, in looking at that plan, heard in the testimony some concerns that needed to be addressed in that plan. And that included the testimony about the oldest child wanting to spend some of the summers in Lincoln so that she could continue her employment. And that leads into that next issue. The Van Sciver case, I do think, is enough on point in that it talks about the children having the ability to exercise more visitation if they want to, but setting a minimum. In that case, the minimum was zero. So if they exercised any, they were exercising more. In this case, the judge said they have to go for at least the 2 weeks. Normally it's 30 days, 4 weeks, but they have to go for at least two, and then if they are able to and want to go for the full four, they can. It requires the child to work their schedule out in a way with work or whatever their other obligations are that they may not lose their job. You know, if you leave a job for a month, it may not be there when you get back, but you might be able to have more flexibility if it's only a 2 week time period.
Well, is the problem then, I mean, is it in the way it's written? I mean, the way it's written is that they still get 30 days of visitation, but the child can opt out of 2 weeks. If the judge had written that they get 2 weeks and the kids can give them 2 weeks more, would that change, would that bring it more into the orbit of what our existing case law is?
I think potentially it could. I think that would be probably clearer as far as what's expected of the children. I think the issue you run into is that when you have children that are of a certain age that have certain activities like team sports or employment where they are expected to be there and they don't get to say, I can't be here for a month because I have to go out west, western Nebraska, that if the child says, I'm not going to take the risk I lose this job, I'm not going to take the risk I get kicked off this team, I'm going to stay here, the problem is not then with the other parents, with the child. And we don't want parents trying to hold children in contempt or arguing that their child is the problem here. It's just going to continue the conflict between the parents. There needs to be a little flexibility there, because especially when you've got two litigious parents, the way we do here, I expect there to be further issues when you have children that are starting to say, I don't want to go across the state for 30 days when I've got things I need to do here. And the parents are the ones that are expected to figure it out, and they can't even communicate about medications.
Van Sciver's, though, is significantly different. I mean, didn't the Supreme Court ultimately say, hey, we're allowing this here because the court found that there were no parental visitation rights here with regard to father, isn't it?
The way I read it was that they found that there was an enforceable plan in that there was no visitation. If there's an enforceable plan that says there's at least 2 weeks, but the children can come more, then I think that is still enforceable by mom if she doesn't get her 2 weeks. And the children have the option that they could go the full 30 days if they chose to. I think that the problem with situations like this where you have five very different children is that each child may need a different understanding of what's necessary. You know, some children might be employed, some children might be in sports. It's going to be really hard to hold all five children to the same standard, and there needs to be some flexibility there.
And we also see the cases that as the kids get older during their teen years, they just don't want to go, period, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And then that causes issues.
It does. And again, that's why I think having the minimum in there is important, not saying that there's nothing in there that says the children don't have to go at all and that they never have to go see a parent. I think that the parents have the ability to enforce the plan as written. The problem, again, is that you are now setting up circumstances where mom files a contempt against dad or vice versa, and the star witness is the child, and having them come in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Good.
All right, thank you, Ms. Camplin.
Thank you.
And I believe we also took Mr. McIntosh over. So the case will be submitted, and we will issue a decision as soon as we can. You are excused. The next case is Hudkins versus Hempel.